Evans. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and the appellant will have 5 minutes rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, just adjust the microphone to your level, and the podium goes up and down, and just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bradford Colbert. I represent the appellant in this matter, Alverna Bedeau. This case arises from a constitutional challenge to Minnesota's predatory registration statute. The statute is problematic because it requires people to register as predatory offenders even if they have never been convicted of a predatory offense. It requires registration for people who have only been charged with a predatory offense. The BCA argues that requiring people who've only been charged with a predatory offense, and I'm quoting here, accomplishes the objective of not allowing offenders to enter plea bargains to circumvent their registration requirements, thus defeating the purpose of the statute. This argument is exactly...
Well, I mean, that's right, isn't it?
Well, it's exactly what's wrong with the statute.
And that's what the legislature, as I understand it, I'm not sure if the record bears it out, attempted to achieve, because what they were seeing were complaints that had a charge requiring mandatory registration dismissed and then having the defendant plead to something else, and they didn't like that, so hence this new law.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what that, I think, is a fundamental misreading of the way the law works, in fact, because what that assumes that is if you've been charged with the offense, you are guilty of the offense, and the plea bargains are some way of getting out of the charged offense. When in fact, if you've been charged with that offense, you are presumed innocent of that offense, even though you have been charged. The only finding has been a probable cause, which is the lowest standard. So that's exactly what is wrong with the statute. It's a just completely contrary to our most fundamental understanding of how the law should work.
Is the statute at issue in this case materially different or the same as the statute that our Supreme Court considered in the Boutin versus LaFleur case?
It is substantially different, and I will go through the ways of the difference. But I think it's also important to go back and find, you know, go back to the idea of Paul versus Davis, which sets out the stigma plus test. And the stigma plus test, the idea is you first have to have stigma, the idea that somehow we are calling you something that you are not. And that's what is happening in this case. They're calling her a predatory offender, which of course is a euphemism for a sex offender, and everyone perceives that that way. They're saying you are a sex offender, and even though she was never convicted of a sex offense. So you have the stigma, and Boutin versus Lohr recognized that. And stigma, and Paul versus Davis said defaming someone, the government defaming somebody, is not sufficient to raise a claim for procedural due process. So if the government was just calling her a sex offender, she would not have. You must have the plus requirement. The plus requirement, I think, should be sufficient, the idea that you have to register. But Boutin versus LaFleur in a 4-3 case said that wasn't sufficient. But that was in 1999. 20 years later, the legislature has changed. And they changed the requirements and made it substantially more onerous, and I'll walk through them.
But the court, this court, considered those changes in that in the Collier case of, I think, in 2017. An unpublished opinion. I understand it's not precedential, but many of the arguments you're raising here, Mr. Colbert, were raised in that case, were rejected by the Court of Appeals, and review was denied by the Supreme Court. So why would we assume that the Supreme Court has changed its view in light of these changes here that you're talking about in the statute?
Well, I think if many of the arguments are the same. I represent Mr. Collier, so many arguments are the same. But I think if you look at Judge Cleary's concurring opinion in that case, I think that is. And I do think it is time. I do think this court needs to look at it. And the fact that it has that unpublished decision, it's clearly not precedential. But I think, again, there's a fundamental problem here. And I think if this court should recognize that. And if it's clear, Collier said no, but that doesn't mean this court cannot. And I think this court should. And I, and again, let me explain to you why I think it's there is a requirement here.
Yeah, and I may agree with Chief Judge Cleary's concurring opinion, but the Supreme Court had the same opinion in front of them when they denied review. And so it seems like they may have spoken as recently as a year or so ago that they're not ready to review this again.
Well, as the court's well aware, the denying review, it doesn't mean anything, right? That doesn't have any precedential value. That just simply means that for whatever reason, they're not taking this case. And quite frankly, I think if this court were to decide something contrary to Boughton, then the Supreme Court might consider it. So I think it's
I think they definitely would consider it. They issued an opinion not long ago where they kind of yelled at us here on the Court of Appeals for ignoring their precedent.
Well, and I think, but I think this is different. And I do think, I believe in the system of justice, and I think it's incumbent upon a court's look at it. And let me give
your suggestion is the common law needs to develop and that this court is part of that development and that we should recognize that the world is different because of that there are more registration requirements and the healthcare facilities are now part of the whole notification scheme. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And I do want to emphasize the healthcare requirement. So what if you're to register as a predatory offender before you enter a hospital or a treatment facility, you must tell that hospital that you are a predatory offender or what they would perceive as a sex offender. You must tell them I am a predatory offender before you can. And again, going back to this case, this is a case where my client was not convicted, but she has to tell them by law that she is a predatory offender. And then
has she had to do this? I mean, is there a question of whether she has standing to make these arguments? I mean, has she been denied a right to interstate travel? Has she been denied or had her access to health care impeded or delayed because of these requirements?
No, Your Honor, it's not. I mean, again, it was summary judgment, so we didn't really develop the record to that extent. But in the sense of it is a law requirement, so in that sense, and again, so she has to tell the admissions people at the hospital. That is required by law. And in addition to that, then the hospital, and it's not quite clear how they do this, frankly, but the hospital must then tell every patient in the hospital that this person is a predatory offender. Must tell every person in the hospital. And what were the argument is not, you know, I quite frankly think that's absurd, but at the same time, our argument is this just gets us to the idea of the liberty interest. That's all this court is I'm asking this court to say, is there a liberty interest in being called by your government a sex offender and being required to fulfill all those requirements? Does a person have a right to challenge that designation made by the government? Does my client have a constitutional right to challenge that designation where the government says you are a sex offender and because you are a sex offender, you must follow all the requirements of the registration statute? All we are arguing at this point is saying we deserve a constitutional right, a procedural due process right to challenge that determination by the government. We should have a right to challenge that determination.
Why wasn't your client's ability to challenge probable cause in the underlying criminal matter a sufficient way to exercise that right?
Well, actually, she had that whole charge dismissed. In fact, she was successful in dismissing that charge.
Well, part of the plea agreement, as I understand it, was that was dismissed, and she pleaded guilty to the to an assault charge or something else. But I mean, didn't she have a chance before entering that plea to challenge probable cause for the false imprisonment offense?
The charge was dismissed. So it's a little bit like for the example I was thinking, if someone says you owe this plus interest, and you were to challenge that that with the credit company, and the credit company says, okay, you're right, you don't owe it, and we're not going to charge you interest, we'll forget the whole thing. And then they say, well, we want to make sure you do the interest as well. And it goes, well, it's all dismissed. She got the entire charge dismissed. There isn't any incentive for her to challenge the probable cause at that time. And again,
except that if she, had she been successful, she wouldn't have be subject to the registration requirement. I mean, the law at the time of her plea required registration. She was aware of that. She admitted in pleading guilty that she knew even though that charge was dismissed, she would be having to register.
It's not clear to me the standard for which you can send. You know, first of all, let's talk about the standard for probable cause. In fact, that is lower than preponderance of the evidence. So the idea is, and the probable cause is on the face of the complaint. If you just look at the complaint, it's not clear whether she has a right to challenge it beyond the face of the complaint, whether she can bring evidence in. It's not even clear what process she can do that. It's an ex parte. The complaint is signed by the judge, ex parte, so that is, and in the face of the complaint, whether that is.
But, sure, but she. But all defendants have the right to actually challenge probable cause and have an evidentiary hearing if the situation warrants.
I go back to the idea of that particular charge was dismissed. And so if she were to say, I know it was dismissed, but I want to challenge the probable cause portion, I'm not sure a judge would let her. It's not, and quite frankly, I've been doing this for 35 years. I have literally never seen that happen, where the charge is dismissed and the person says, oh, and I want to challenge the probable cause as well. And again, even if, let's presume, the idea of the probable cause, why is that sufficient to hold somebody responsible for being a predatory offender? Again, in this society, it's a euphemism for sex offender. The idea that you can call somebody a sex offender based on probable cause, which is just above reasonable suspicion. It doesn't mean that you are. It doesn't even mean by a preponderance of the evidence. So we are challenging the idea of, and again, going back to the original argument, is she doesn't have a liberty interest. So what Boughton says, doesn't matter. You don't have a right to it. So whether, you know, the idea of the process is something, isn't, we're not there yet. This court first has to find a liberty interest. Then we can talk about what process is, and I think that should be an important part. How do you challenge registration? How should you challenge registration? I think that's a really difficult, complicated question, but this first court first need to decide you have a liberty interest, and I think that's what it should decide. I want to briefly address the substantive due process issue and the idea of I think that whether it's a rational basis or a strict scrutiny, I think that's a difficult question. But I want to go to the idea of just assuming this is a rational basis, just assuming you look at a rational basis. In Boughton, the Supreme Court said the primary purpose of the registration statute is to create an offender registry to assist law enforcement with investigation. I think the idea is that if a crime is committed, then law enforcement in the area would know in the area people who had committed that crime, kind of like Casablanca, round up the usual suspects. I think that's the idea. It makes a modicum of sense, and I barely a bit of sense, in cases where you have someone who has been convicted of sexual relations with a 7-year-old, because this idea, which I don't even know if it's true, but this idea that they're out there, we're going to find them, it may make a little sense. It makes no sense in this case. My client was involved in a drunken altercation with her mother and her mother's brother. It's impossible for me to discern any reason that this would help law enforcement further any investigation. And to make it even more absurd, if she, in fact, had come into the apartment and shot and killed her mother and her mother's boyfriend, she would not have to register as a predatory offender. It is an irrational statute.
She would still be in prison.
She'd be in prison, probably. But she would not have to register, which I think just goes to the idea of the irrational. I'm just glad that's not my phone. That it is. It's an irrational statute.
You should be
statute.
Glad none of us are Peg Marinan.
Yeah, thank you. It's an irrational statute. It does not survive rational basis in this case. And I'd ask this court to look closely at this issue and find that, first, that she does have a liberty interest in challenging the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Colbert. You will have rebuttal. Will hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Attorney General Angela Kiza, appearing on behalf of the respondent. When I'm working on, was working on this case, and really this a series of cases that have been brought, that have been similar, raised similar issues, what I keep, maybe in a frustrated way, keep thinking in defending the statute is that these issues raised are collateral consequences of a collateral consequence. And another kind of recurring theme is it's portrayed that the BCA is forcing registration. The BCA is charged with administering the statute. The BCA is applying the statute that they're charged with administering. They're not on some vindictive, trip to register everyone they can. They're looking at the statute and they're applying the statute where the legislature and the citizens of Minnesota through the legislature have determined it applies. And the other thing that keeps coming up in these cases is, oh, the BCA is requiring people to register based on a charge. No, they are not. Their statute requires a charge for a listed predatory offense that our legislature has deemed a proper and appropriate predatory offense and a conviction for an offense arising out of the same set of circumstances. They don't just say, oh, he was charged with this, so he must, the charge was dismissed. Nothing else ever happened. Oh, we're going to register him. That doesn't happen. They have to be charged with the registered offense and convicted. And not just convicted, but convicted of an offense arising out of the same set of circumstances. And there is due process as far as procedural due process is concerned because, yes, they can charge or they can challenge probable cause. And no,
but as a practical matter, when does that happen? If I think in this case the charges were registered in April and it was 6 months later when the guilty plea was entered.
Right.
So you're saying that there could have been a probable cause motion somewhere in that time?
Correct. If there was not probable cause for false imprisonment, then bring a motion under the rules and challenge probable cause for the false imprisonment. Don't wait until after the charge is resolved and after you say, I understand I'm going to have to register as a result of this plea, and you go through sentencing, and the judge says, you're going to have to register as a result of this plea, and you acknowledge that the whole time, and then say, oh, well, I didn't have a chance, I didn't have procedural due process. Yes, you did. You could have challenged that probable cause. They knew the whole time that the law required registration in this case if she was convicted of an offense arising out of the same set of circumstances as false imprisonment. So the time to challenge that would have been, if they thought the probable there was not probable cause for that charge, they should have challenged it. If they thought there was some issue with the same set of circumstances, they should have challenged it. None of that was done in this case. And in fact, there was probable cause if you look at the probable cause statement in the complaint, that probable cause was found by the court. And this did arise out of the same set of circumstances if you look at the complaint. So maybe they wouldn't have been successful, but registration clearly applies under the statute in this case.
Ms. Kiesa, what do you think of Mr. Colbert's argument based on Judge Cleary's opinion on the stigma plus that it seems since the Supreme Court issued its original decision, you know, there are a lot more things that flow out of being listed and designated as a predatory offender?
Well, I think a couple of things. For one thing, we have all kinds of standing issues in this case, as we mentioned in our brief and as Judge Berkman brought up. She has not, Ms. Bedeau, has not had any issues with not getting access to health care, with any kind of notification to healthcare facilities, with anything in that regard. She hasn't had any issues with ordinances being applied to her that she's saying somehow add to that burden, even though the ordinances have nothing to do with the statute itself. I mean, these are ordinances that are passed by municipalities. You know, if those are going to be challenged, those challenges should go through municipalities. Even if this 244057, I mean, there's no authority that says because some other statute says registration requires something, that makes the registration statute invalid. This 244057 is
but,
a
but
deal.
But at some point, the registration, which I think in Booten, the Supreme Court said that, you know, the registration burdens are minimal, right? Words to that effect. I mean, where's the line? It seems to me those registration requirements are no longer have a minimal impact on someone. And I appreciate what Mr. Colbert said, that this was a summary judgment issue, and so arguably there would have been testimony developed at a hearing about the impact of these various registration requirements and ordinances and everything had on the plaintiff if there had been an evidentiary hearing. But, I mean, where do we cross this line? Why isn't it time to reconsider Booten and just say, you know, yes, these are civil regulatory consequences, but they have gone beyond minimal?
Well, I mean, if you look at the consequences, and as the Collier Court pointed out, to the extent that has changed, for the most part, aside from, as Collier Court pointed out, aside from the health care issue, and I think there was one other issue that they pointed out was different. Oh, the 244057 issue, which is a different statute. But aside from those issues that were also argued in Collier, it is just providing additional information. So it really doesn't add to the burden, you know, or add to the plus very much, if at all, part of that analysis. And again, as far as the healthcare facility issue is concerned, Ms. Biddle doesn't have standing for that. But even if she did, that's rationally related to the statute. And yeah, maybe the primary purpose, the theory is to, you know, get this, be able to track registered offenders. Well, part of that certainly is that they're in a facility, but you also have vulnerable patients in a facility like that. And I think that certainly there, you know, that is part of the rational basis or part of the objective of the statute, or that part of the statute is you have to provide some kind of protection for people who are vulnerable in a healthcare facility as far as the knowledge that there's a registered offender there. I mean, so I think that does fall into the rational basis, and it doesn't significantly increase the plus factor, and certainly not for somebody who it hasn't even been applied to. I mean, I'm relatively healthy, but I haven't had to go to a facility. But if I did and I was a registered offender, so be it. I mean, I have to file taxes every year. You know what I mean? So I don't know that you – I mean, I think you only get to the plus portion if somebody's really – if they're, you know, if registration really – if the statute says you can't go to another state, if the statute says you can't live in a certain place – if the statute, you know, some of the things that are being raised certainly could make the registration statute unconstitutional if it was actually part of the statute or if it was actually something that the BCA administered. I mean, when I said about collateral consequences of collateral consequences, I feel like, and I think that the district court below kind of said this, you know, we don't know, people who have criminal records have trouble getting housing. They have trouble getting jobs. The BCA doesn't make decisions for landlords or control what landlords do. The BCA doesn't control what families do as far as whether they're willing to let people live with them. The BCA doesn't control what employers do as far as, you know, if somebody, whether they're registered or not, if a criminal applies for a job. You know what I mean? So, I mean, at some point, you ask at what point do, you know, does the statute become, you know, meet that plus test? You know, I think it only does if it really crosses into that kind of thing and puts those kinds of restrictions on somebody just because they're a registered offender. When they're just collecting information, when the legislature has deemed it appropriate to pass a separate statute saying, human services should be notified, or child protection, if there's a registered offender that's going to live in a certain place. You know, that's something that statute, is that rationally related to the objective of that statute?
It all flows from the initial registration requirement. And how do you respond to the argument that the statute doesn't differentiate between the pedophile and the person who got into a dispute with an adult family member and, you know, and momentarily refuse to let that person leave the apartment?
Well, I mean, it's like with any statute. There are going to be situations, you know, where somebody maybe falls into it that, you know, it's the same issue that was debated years ago about, yeah, there are some registered offenders who maybe were, maybe it was an 18-year-old in a consensual relationship with a, you know, what is the range, 14-year-old or whatever, 13-year-old, I don't know how what the range is. But does that, you know, is that person, you know, need the same kind of attention from a registration standpoint as somebody who's, you know, gone to a daycare and sexually abused kids? Probably not. I mean, by virtue of...
And yet the stigma or the stigma plus is the same, whether it's the senior in high school dating the freshman or the person that goes into the daycare center.
Well, I wouldn't say it's the same because I think it's going to, again, it's going to depend on what their criminal history is and what the other aspects of their life are.
But if they both have to register, I'm saying that the stigma of the registration and the, and what flows from the registration is the same.
Right, and I think by nature that's true with a lot of laws and with a lot of consequences. I mean, you're going to have the same consequences for a drunk driver, whether somebody fell asleep at the wheel in the parking lot and they were arrested there, or whether they were driving recklessly down the street. They're going to get the same consequences for that, you know, if they're charged with the same offense for that.
So what if the legislature passed the law that said anybody who's convicted of a crime has to register as an offender? Not a predatory offender, not a sexual offender, but just an offender. Would that be constitutional? And subject to the same requirements that this registration statute decides. And you're an offender. You've broken the law, so you've offended.
Well, then I think...
And it doesn't matter whether it's been... Whether... I'm not talking about even if it was dismissed out of the circumstances, you know, arising out of circumstances. Anyone who's been convicted of any crime, misdemeanor and above,
has to register
as an offender. And that information has to be provided like that. What about that?
I wouldn't think there would be a rational basis for that, but without knowing more. But I... So I think that would be an issue.
What's the rational,
unless they could, unless the there could be some rational basis for.
What's the rational basis then for this one, where even if the charge has been dismissed, which means you haven't been convicted of it, what's the rational basis?
Well, what our Supreme Court has indicated is that there's a rational basis with respect to keeping the registry, and that the same set of circumstances is a rational way of doing that. In Boughton, they said that. And in Lopez, they said that it was reasonable.
So it's reasonable to keep a list of people who haven't been convicted of these sets of crimes because you never know?
No, because they have, because they've been charged with the registration offense that our legislature has deemed to be an appropriate registration offense as far as the recidivism issues are concerned, and that they've been convicted of an offense arising out of the same set of consequences. So that's different than just saying they've been charged with an offense, and it's different from just saying they've been convicted of any criminal offense. There's a specific set of offenses that our legislature has deemed to be predatory offenses, and based on legislative hearings and testimony and based on that and the requirement to be convicted out of the same set of circumstances. And our Supreme Court has looked at the constitutionality both with substantive and procedural due process and has found that it meets constitutional scrutiny on both substantive and procedural due process. And the things raised here do not change the bulk of that analysis, which is with respect to, you know, having to provide information. Most of it is that. And then, as I said, you know, anything that's added as far as tracking homeless offenders, as far as healthcare facilities, you know, that's something that's also rationally related not only to tracking offenders but to protecting the vulnerable patients in those facilities. Seeing that I'm almost out of time, unless you have any other questions, I will ask you to affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Counsel for the appellant, you'll have rebuttal, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to make, a really important point that I think gets lost, is under the constitutional analysis of Boughton, a conviction is not required. The government could determine that someone is a predatory offender. and force them to register. No, because you have no right, you have no liberty interest to challenge that determination. Boughton says you don't have a liberty interest. You don't have a constitutional right to challenge that determination.
Well, but Boughton was in the context of a statute that requires that there be a conviction for some crime arising out of the same set of circumstances.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And they keep going, well, this is what the statute requires. And that's true. But the analysis is they're saying there is no liberty interest in not registering. It does not require a conviction, that analysis. So if they say, let's say the government decides, we're going to make people who rent R-rated movies register because there's a rational basis for so whatever reason, that can you don't have a constitutional right to challenge that because what the court has said, you don't have a liberty interest in not registering. It's true that this—
Because it's a civil regulation. It's not a criminal consequence.
Absolutely. They're just saying registration, which— It doesn't, frankly, that's absurd, the idea that you cannot challenge a registration. You don't have a due process right to challenge a registration requirement. It is true that this particular statute requires a conviction, but that's not the analysis. The analysis is they're saying there is no liberty interest. You do not have a due process right to challenge the constitutionality of registration. So if they change their mind, if they say, we're just going to make people register based on probable cause, even if the complaint is dismissed, you can't, the person still couldn't challenge it because the court has determined there's no liberty interest. So if the state changes the statute and say at some time, at any time in the past, they found probable cause, and even though that complaint has been dismissed for lack of probable cause, whatever reason, you can't challenge it because there is no liberty interest. You do not have a right to challenge that determination. That's the gravamen of the harm here. The process, more complicated, but it is not complicated that there is a liberty interest. And Boughton, in my opinion, was wrongly decided. The years since that has made it clear that it's wrongly decided. The other piece is, you know, the counsel says, well, the BCA is just administering the statute. Well, in fact, if this judge had said, you do not need to register, if the judge had made a determination looking at the facts of this particular case and made a determination that said, you know what, this, you should not have to register, the BCA would come in and say, that isn't what the statute says. We are requiring you to register because probable cause was found on this case. So the BCA takes it upon themselves to make that determination, and if you look at the
but
case—
But presumably, if the let's say for the sake of argument, without a hearing, to challenge probable cause, the judge said, you know, I've looked at this complaint, and I don't think there was probable cause for an offense which required registration. Presumably, and, you know, then so don't register. Presumably, are you suggesting the BCA would challenge it under those circumstances, too?
It seems to indicate that if they make a determination of no probable cause, then maybe the BCA would not. Okay. But if the court just said, under the circumstances, it's quite clear that registration should not apply to you, the BCA would say, that's not your call. That is our call. That, again, goes to the problem, the constitutional problems inherent in this statute. And if there were a conviction, then the process, then the flows from convictions. It would be difficult to argue, if, you know, in the sense of because then you have the process of the conviction. This is not a conviction. This is simply a charge. So we're asked that this court find that her constitutional rights have been violated. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.